Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Claire Dickinson. I'm here this morning on behalf of plaintiff appellant Cliff Dumas. The issue in this case is whether there was before the district court evidence when viewed most strongly in favor of Mr. Dumas that would support a claim of promissory estoppel that would not be barred by the statute of frauds. And I would submit to the court that there was. And that evidence was in the form of a series of emails from an employee of Infinity known as Justin Case to Mr. Dumas. The initial emails took place during the year 2000 at a time when Mr. Dumas and Infinity were initially talking about the possibility of Mr. Dumas coming to work for Infinity. Those negotiations fell through because they weren't able to agree upon an amount of compensation. Infinity had offered a five-year contract which started at $150,000 a year and grew to $190,000 by the fifth year. Mr. Dumas was looking for more than that, and so the negotiations fell through. Mr. Dumas then went to work for a radio station in New Mexico. Late in 2001, I'm sorry, Your Honor. They could not agree on the compensation at that point, I believe, in 1990. No, they offered a five-year contract. Then in late 2001, Mr. Case contacted Mr. Dumas again, and negotiations started again about the possibility of Mr. Dumas coming to work for Infinity. Early on in the negotiations this time, Mr. Case sent an email asking Mr. Dumas what range he was looking for, and gave Mr. Dumas referred to it as a multiple choice question, gave four different ranges, including the range of $175,000 to $225,000. And Mr. Dumas responded by saying that he was looking for the range of $175,000 to $225,000. In response to that, Mr. Case sent an email saying, we have a real possibility here, and said that we may have to compromise. You may have to prove yourself, and after being informed of the range that Mr. Dumas was looking for, Mr. Case moved ahead with the negotiations. He instructed Mr. Dumas to send tapes, which Mr. Dumas did. Eventually, there was, in fact, an oral contract agreed to. Now, we cannot enforce that oral contract because of the statute of frauds. That's why we have fallen back on the promissory estoppel, because there is sufficient written evidence to enforce the promissory estoppel. And the kind of the final nail in Infinity's coffin was an email in which Mr. Case instructed Mr. Dumas that an oral release from his contract in New Mexico was not sufficient for Infinity, that they needed a written release from the contract in New Mexico. Now, putting the emails together, we have the fact that Mr. Case, on behalf of Infinity, was willing to continue negotiations after being informed that Mr. Dumas was looking for a contract of 5 years starting at least $175,000. And then Mr. Case told Dumas, you need to get a written release from the New Mexico station and before we can move forward. That is, I believe, an implied promise that if you get that release, you will be offered a position for at least paying at least $175,000 a year for 5 years. And that's what our claim is based upon. The appellee has suggested that inasmuch as we have not appealed the district court's conclusion that we cannot recover based upon the contract, we also cannot recover based upon promissory estoppel. The distinction, however, is that there's a difference between the evidence that supports the contract and the evidence that supports the promissory estoppel. The evidence that supports the contract is oral. Mr. Dumas testified that the contract, under the contract, he was to be paid $175,000 for the first 2 years, $200,000 for the third and fourth year, and $210,000 for the fifth year. We can't support that with documentary evidence. All we can support with documentary evidence was that he was promised that if he got the release, he would be offered a position of at least $175,000 a year. And if there are no questions, I'll sit down at this point. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Alyssa Campbell of Williams, Montgomery & John on behalf of the Appellee Infinity Broadcasting Corporation. The summary judgment should be affirmed because there are no reasonable inferences that can turn this handful of emails that have been attached to the appellant's brief into the requirement of the statute of frauds of a sufficient writing in order for them to establish their promissory estoppel claim. Now, there are several points raised in the appellant's reply brief that we never had an opportunity to address that bear some discussion. First, and this was raised again this morning, is this new argument that the appellant's promissory estoppel claim is somehow different in kind or effect than their breach of contract claim. That is a new argument raised for the first time in the reply brief. And for that reason, under Evans versus Floor Distributing Company, which is cited in the briefs already, the argument should be considered waived. In the district court, if we look from the complaint forward, the plaintiff always took the position that the very same set of facts that supported and proved up their breach of contract claim also supported and proved up their promissory estoppel claim. The complaint was drafted with a set of common factual allegations, with a brief count for promissory estoppel based on that common set of facts, and then a breach of contract claim based on that same set of facts. When our motion for summary judgment was filed, the plaintiff's response again addressed the same set of emails and argued why those emails satisfied the writing requirements for the statute of frauds for both claims. And the same point was made in the opening brief. In fact, on page 15 of the brief, of the appellant's opening brief, he says, inasmuch as the district court determined that that contract was not enforceable because of the statute of frauds, however, Dumas must fall back on promissory estoppel to attempt to enforce Infinity's promise. And the first time that we heard this distinction between a $875,000 agreement for the promissory estoppel claim versus a $980,000 agreement for the breach of contract claim is in the reply brief, once we make the proper argument that because these counts are based on the same set of facts, because the claims relied on the identical set of emails to support the writing requirement, once the plaintiff abandoned the one claim, he necessarily abandoned the other claim. That's That's the waiver issue. The other issue is that this distinction that the appellant tries to draw really places the wrong focus on the issues for promissory estoppel. The appellant's arguing that they can show through these emails, which we dispute, that there was an agreement or an implicit promise to pay $175,000 a year at least. Well, in order to satisfy the statute of frauds for their promissory estoppel claim, they need to prove up sufficient writings to show a promise to employ Mr. Dumas. That relies on the very same set of emails that they're relying on for the breach of contract. And at most, what they're arguing is that those emails show a promise to pay $175. They are not arguing that those emails prove in writing all the other essential terms to show a promise to employ him. So we maintain that the plaintiff's strategic decision, for whatever reason, to abandon their breach of contract claim has now defeated their case entirely. The second thing is that if we review the briefs filed here, the appellant never contests our point that you cannot have an implied oral promise support a promissory estoppel claim where the statute of frauds is a defense. We raised that in our brief. They do not respond to it in their reply brief. They've not addressed that again this morning. The third thing, the appellant's claim in their or in his reply brief that for the statute of frauds in the promissory estoppel context, it somehow requires some lesser degree of evidence or less detail than the statute of frauds requires in the breach of contract context. Now, there's no authority cited in the brief to support that proposition. And it's inaccurate. The one case that the appellants do cite, Goldstick versus ICM Realty, a Seventh Circuit case from 1986, and they cite that case for the proposition that a breach of contract claim somehow requires more specificity. In the brief time I have, I won't go into all the facts of that case, but I would suggest that a careful review of that case shows that there were two different promises at issue in the Goldstick case. There was first a breach of contract claim that was based on a supposed offer to pay $250,000 in exchange for a release. When the breach of contract claim failed, the plaintiff also asserted a promissory estoppel claim, and the promise was not a promise to pay $250,000. It was a promise that the parties would work things out and perhaps pay a fee that was owed irrespective of a profit on a piece of real estate. So the promises at issue for the promissory estoppel claim were different than the promise at issue for the breach of contract claim. And therefore, in that case, it does not support the plaintiff's position, and it is not inconsistent with our position that where the promise is the same here, the promise to employ Mr. Dumas for a certain position, to start at a certain date and for a certain length of time, along with many other terms of that employment, that's the promise at issue. It's identical for both. On the issue of the claim of promissory estoppel, apart from the statute of frauds, which we contend is an insurmountable obstacle to going forward with the promissory estoppel claim, but on the merits of the claim, the appellant cannot satisfy the necessary elements for promissory estoppel. It requires an unambiguous promise by the defendant, the plaintiff's reliance on that. The plaintiff's reliance must be expected and foreseeable to the defendant, and the plaintiff must reasonably rely to his detriment. In their briefs, the appellants have focused on whether Mr. Dumas reasonably relied to his detriment. What they don't deal with, and have not today as well, is whether that reliance was expected and foreseeable to Infinity. And we've established on the record that it's not, because there were a set of procedures that needed to be followed. There was a hierarchy of management that needed to interview potential employees, that needed to sign off on various written documents, such as a personal action form and a term sheet. There needed to be a personal interview. None of those procedures were followed, and nevertheless, Mr. Dumas unexpectedly quit his job. And so, irrespective of whether his reliance was reasonable, which we dispute as well, the appellants have not given this court any argument or basis to establish a requisite element of their promissory estoppel claim that that reliance would be expected and foreseeable to the defendant. Unless the court has further questions, I would rely on whatever other points we've raised in our brief and ask that the court affirm the summary judgment.
Thank you, Your Honor. Beginning where Ms. Campbell left off on the question of was it expected and foreseeable that Mr. Dumas would rely upon what he was told by Mr. Case, it was clearly expected and foreseeable based upon two things. One, when the initial negotiations were taking place in the year 2000, Mr. Dumas was told that Mr. Case is the person with whom you need to negotiate. Mr. Dumas would reasonably have believed that whatever approvals Mr. Case needed, he would have gotten. The internal operations of Infinity are not within Mr. Dumas's knowledge. And secondly, in terms of would it have been expected and foreseeable that Mr. Dumas would give up his job in New Mexico based upon what Mr. Case told him. What Mr. Case told him was, you need to get a written release from your contract in New Mexico before we can go forward with this. So how could it be anything except expected and foreseeable that he would rely upon that if he, in fact, wanted to go through with getting the job with Infinity? Now, I concede that I did not respond in my reply brief to Ms. Campbell's argument about an implied oral promise, and I confess that the reason I did not respond to that is because I cannot fathom what an implied oral promise is. Now, I can understand that there would be an implied promise based upon an oral statement, and we're not relying upon an implied promise based upon an oral statement. We are relying upon an implied promise based upon the documentary evidence in the form of the emails. The implied promise being, get us this release and you will be offered a position paying at least $175,000. And by the way, on the question of whether that was raised in our opening brief, it was raised in our opening brief, specifically on page 20. We talk about the promise that we're talking about is that he would be paid at least $175,000 a year. That's after we've already stated in our statement of facts what the oral contract had been. So that's the promise that we're talking about. In terms of Goldstick is relevant to this case because it shows that you can have a promissory estoppel based upon a promise that is clear on the low end, but not clear, not including all of the specific provisions that would be included in a contract. And I do not understand why Ms. Campbell believes that that a promise that you'll be offered a job paying at least $175,000 has to include all of the terms of the employment. They could be filled in later. If Mr. Dumas didn't like it, he could turn it down. But he had made a decision based upon what he had been told. Thank you, Your Honor.